Facing the Truth with Grace and Courage.
Things are meant to be confronted. They're meant to be looked directly in the eye. And it doesn't mean that you're not afraid, and it doesn't mean that you're not suffering, and it doesn't mean that you don't have moments of weakness or terror even. But the only way to cope with that stuff is really to confront it and to learn, okay, now this is my situation, how do I deal with that?
That's John Duberstein. We talk with him about his late wife's powerful and lyric memoir of living and dying, The Bright Hour. Nina Riggs died just shortly before the book was published from metastatic breast cancer, leaving her husband and two young children behind. Then we play a clip from our interview in 2015 with Joseph Luzzi about his memoir, In a Dark Wood. After he lost his wife to a car accident, he was helped to heal from his grief by his study of Dante's Divine Comedy. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In 2015, at the age of 38, Nina Riggs was diagnosed with breast cancer. It was aggressive, and later that year, Nina and her husband, John Duberstein, learned it had spread to her bones. Riggs, a poet, began a memoir, The Bright Hour, that was published just a month after she died from the disease. Nina Riggs was the great-great-great-granddaughter of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and she found inspiration in the philosophical works of her illustrious ancestor, as well as in the writings of Michel de Montaigne. Both men counseled facing life as it comes and finding beauty in living no matter what the circumstances. The title, The Bright Hour, comes from a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Riggs also derived inspiration from her mother, who was battling her own deadly cancer when her daughter was diagnosed. She died just a few months before Riggs, but not before bequeathing her daughter an example of humor in the face of the unbearable and an unquenchable joie de vivre. Nina Riggs received her MFA in poetry in 2004 and published a book of poems, Lucky, Lucky, in 2009. She wrote about life with metastatic breast cancer on her blog, Suspicious Country. Her work also appeared in The Washington Post and The New York Times. Well, John Duberstein, welcome to Writer's Voice. We're talking with you about your wife's really stunningly powerful memoir, The Bright Hour, a memoir of living and dying, and not to your wife, because she died at the end of February, just a few months before the publication of this book. You know, first, I just want to ask you, what's it like for you to be talking about her book? Aren't you very early in the grieving process yourself?
I am, and I mean, the grieving process is, it's one that can go on for a very long time, if not forever. But I'm really, really glad to be talking about it, both with you specifically and with people in general. And I've been talking about Nina and her book off and on, almost literally since the moment she passed away. When she died, she had completed her manuscript and it had just barely started the editing process, but she didn't really get to do any of the promotional stuff that an author would normally do. So it really was left to me, and I feel like there's this thing where it's kind of a commonplace where, you know, there's people speak in hushed tones or avoid talking about the person who's died. And I think most of the people who are bereaved don't actually want that. They just don't know how to negotiate that with the outside world. For them, I think they are constantly the spouse or the parent or the child of someone who's died, brother or sister, whatever it may be. They really get a lot out of being reminded of their person, this person that they loved, that they lost, or that they cared about, that they lost. And so for me, I don't have to do those negotiations. I don't have to find ways to talk about Nina. I get this like super deep, really detailed, really engaged conversation about Nina and about not just her and not just our family, but her wider family and our friends and the topic of the disease itself, of breast cancer, and all of this stuff that she put into the memoir, and it really started immediately for me. So I feel like my grieving process has really been aided and accelerated in some ways. I don't know how I would have dealt with it absent the book. I'd like to think that I would have tried to engage with all of my memories of Nina and all of our friends and family, but I know that the book has really enabled me to circulate and to communicate and to exchange meaningful things with people in ways that I never would have been able to do without the book. So, you know, it's people keep saying, you know, what a tremendous gift that she left in this book. And I just, that can't be overstated. It really can't. It's been really a magical part of all of this stuff. And it just has guided me through to the point. We're at just over 7 months since she died. We just passed that mark the other day. And I feel like I've already done so much more in terms of engaging with people around her loss than I probably ever could have without the book. So that's a very long answer, a very long way of saying I'm really glad to be talking about her and to be talking about her book. At the same time, it's really weird to be talking about a book that somebody else wrote. There's no question. I'm definitely a stand-in, and I'm not a writer. So it's not just like, you know, Nina and I were both writers and we shared this whatever. And I'm a lawyer. I have a completely other skill set. And she was the artist for sure. And the book is really something that it does make me wish that she had been able to have more of these conversations and to see people's reactions to it. So while selfishly I'm thrilled to be talking about the book, and I really can't talk about it enough or talk about her enough, there is that, you know, that sense of loss that she missed out on this opportunity. She put this piece of art into the world and then didn't get to enjoy the book's success and the book's interaction with real people.
Yes, this is really such a gift, both in terms of the way it expresses the depth of her exploration of her own process, and also a process that is now happening to so many people. First, tell us a little bit about your wife and about her illness and its progression.
Well, boy, I could talk to the whole show about Nina herself. I mean, she was an amazing person, and she came from a wonderful family where her family culture was really built around close relationships. And so that forged a real sense of common purpose, I think, in terms of caring for each other and remaining close and dealing with things and coping with things, but also kind of foreseeing things for each other. She and her mom were really close, and they were constantly at work on future plans or present problems or, you know, just the different aspects of life that were challenging. And then her mom was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in 2007. And that was just it was a huge thing for us, because we hadn't really dealt with cancer. I mean, both of us have members of our family who had cancer. We both have histories of cancer in our larger families, but we hadn't dealt with it as adults, Nina and I. And her mom got this diagnosis, which at the time was just like, you know, it was terrible. There was really no treatment, and it's this systemic blood cancer, and it just was really scary, and we'd never heard of it before. But then her mom lived with the disease for almost a decade. I think it was like 8.5 years. And her original prognosis was like 3 to 5 years. So she really outlived the original measuring stick. And also her mom was kind of the source of like this baseline. I think Nina really does a great job at portraying her mom in the book, because the book isn't just about Nina. The book is really, it's divided into sections. And the first couple of sections really deal a lot more with what it's like to be a daughter of a mom who's dying of cancer. And of course, Nina has this simultaneous diagnosis, but her own mortality, her own metastatic condition, and the progression of the disease sort of unfolds throughout the book. And I think it's important because the experience that we had was really a much longer term experience. And both Nina and I think really learned a lot from her mom and her dad, and seeing them cope with this terminal diagnosis over this really long period of time. They had to get their minds around it. And then Jan, who was just an incredibly hardy human being emotionally, had to learn to live with that, this sort of, you know, sort of Damocles thing over her head all the time, because she had this diagnosis for which you know, the treatments improved over time. There were lots of experimental drugs that that Nina's mom was able to take part in trials and things like that, and new drugs were approved. But none of them were cures. They were all just things that would help keep the disease at bay. And finally, for her mom, we saw her go through this phase where she said, I could go back on treatment that I've had before, but it makes me so unhappy and so just really, you know, debilitated, the side effects of the drugs, that I'm not willing to do treatment anymore after 8.5 years. So we went through this process of diagnosis and then learning to accept and understand the disease, and then finally seeing somebody come to terms with this balancing act. And Nina in the book, I think, has this great section where she says, you know, she and her mom, and then she and I read Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, together. And Nina and I felt like it was this like really incredible tome that just like opened our eyes and cleared some things up that we really didn't understand, and normalized some stuff that we really was appealing to us, different ways that you could have control over your end of life decisions in ways that we hadn't even imagined. And then when Nina talked to her mom about it, her mom said, yeah, it was a great book, and his stuff was right on, but I already knew all that stuff, basically, because she'd been looking at this stuff for, you know, 8 years already. And I think that learning some of those lessons over that period of time is a really great example of the kind of stuff that Nina was equipped with by dint of her parents and their experiences and the way that they raised her and her brother. And because by the time she got her diagnosis, and I think this all kind of leads into the book thing, because it married with her creativity, she had this sense that like things are meant to be confronted. They're meant to be looked directly in the eye. And it doesn't mean that you're not afraid, and it doesn't mean that you're not suffering, and it doesn't mean that you don't have moments of weakness or terror even. But the only way to cope with that stuff is really to confront it and to learn, okay, now this is my situation. How do I deal with that, with this new thing that's come upon me? And I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have been able to do all of that as effectively and you know, to survive the way that we were able to without her mom and without her dad and without their example of being a couple living with this threat of constant threat of mortality and of terminal disease. And you know, there's this passage that Nina cited in her book by Montaigne where it's just a real sort of typical Montaigne quip where he says, cannot be cured, we must learn to endure. And I think that's right. And it's not just about being tough or being stoic or being, you know, having sort of Yankee stiff upper lip stuff, the way I used to tease Nina, because she's, you know, from this old New England family. It's about you have to examine your situation anew all the time, and you have to learn to adjust to it. Otherwise, you're just fighting yourself. And there's another passage, I think, that she quoted from Emerson, where Emerson says, a man has too many enemies than that he can afford to be his own foe. And I think those two passages, I was thinking about this just the other day, I think those two passages really go together. It's not just about being as tough as you can or beating cancer or, you know, persevering until the right, you know, until you can conquer something or being stronger than the disease or anything like that. The endurance that Montaigne was talking about was the endurance of leading a full life, even in the face of the fact that we're all going to die. And I think that's kind of what Emerson was getting at, too. He's talking about not fighting yourself, not getting in your own way. And that was his concept of stoicism and of Montaigne's type of philosophy, was not just to be, you know, absolute about things, but to be absolutely faithful to this idea that you're supposed to have a well-examined life and not just be forcing things and not just be trying to make yourself do what you think is expected or anything like that. And I think, like I said, it was a weird apprenticeship. And I think the book is sort of structured around this dual layer of her mom having cancer and Nina being diagnosed while her mom's in the sort of final phases of her cancer. But it's really all about that. It's all about this concept of understanding your situation, coming to terms with it, and then trying to lead the best life you can that's most in harmony with who you are under those circumstances.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about Nina Rigg's memoir of living and dying, The Bright Hour, with her husband John Duberstein. Rigg's died just a month before publication from metastatic breast cancer. Ralph Waldo Emerson was actually your wife's ancestor, and I was really struck by how she incorporates both Michel de Montaigne and Ralph Waldo Emerson in this book, both writers she's now inspired me to go back and read and or reread. Actually, I'd like to read something on page 45, where Nina talks about, now her first diagnosis was non-metastatic breast cancer. She had, as they said, one small spot, and it was a very aggressive cancer, unfortunately. But she's still there. This is on page 45. She says, one small spot, and then she quotes Emerson's words, one small spot, and the universe is fluid and volatile. They push against each other. One small spot requires the constant energy to keep things contained. The universe is fluid and volatile is scary, but allows for the idea that there are things that cannot be contained. These two thoughts flip around and now cannot be pulled apart. So I wonder if you could comment on that. Tell us what's going on here, because I think it really illumines the absolute veracity of her voice and the way she really looks so deeply into things.
Yeah, I love that passage. And I think what the passage that comes right before, Nina's talking about this Emersonian eye, and there's actually an illustration of it in some of his illuminated versions of his work, and it's this giant eyeball with a man's arms and legs, and it really hits on this idea that, so when she was first diagnosed, she did have just one small spot, but at the same time, that one small spot was made up of cancer cells that were her own cells multiplying out of control. So no matter how limited or how circumscribed that one small spot was, it was also this example of, you know, nature is amazing, and it, you know, human beings are incredible that we even exist, and we're complicated, and we have these amazing systems. And Emerson was truly, I mean, he really felt like nature was God, and it was, you know, his religious experiences, a lot of them took place in nature. But nature can also be really terrible, and nature is human beings, for example, by nature are finite, and we all die. And I think of it as being like the seeds of whatever is eventually going to kill us is contained in our DNA or in our bodies. And that's even more true for somebody who has an expressed cancer.
You know, I want to interrupt you here for a second, because it reminds me of another image in the book. She says at one point, or maybe it was her mother that actually said that, you know, that it's like crossing a bridge over a chasm. People who have cancer can see right to the bottom of that chasm, whereas the rest of, you know, people who are healthy or don't have it, you know, the chasm is obscured by the mists, but it's there all the same.
Right. Yeah, it was actually a cousin of Nina's who lost her husband young to cancer as well, who lent that image to Nina. And it's very true. I mean, I think that's exactly right. It's this idea that mortality only emerges when you are facing it. You know, it's unfortunate in some ways. And I think that was Montaigne's whole project, was he wanted to be constantly facing this idea of death, not because he was morbid and not just because he thought it was the right thing to do, but because it was such an integral part of life. That's the chasm. The chasm doesn't disappear just because of a fog bank. And we know that, but it's still more comforting to walk across it when you don't see all the way down. And it's not that there's anything wrong occasionally with being a little misty about that. But I do think that when you are presented with a diagnosis like Nina had, or like her mom had, for even longer period of time, you don't have that luxury. You see to the bottom all the time, unless you're, you know, unless you really are going to a place where you're not facing what's really happening to you. And I think both Jan, her mom, Nina's mother, and Nina were very fixed in their idea that just really wasn't an option, that it had, you had to look down, you had to see what you were facing. And it wasn't just about, again, bravery or you know, contempt for death or anything like that. It was really just about an authentic experience and still being able to enjoy whatever time they had left by appreciating what they were really facing.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. Again, I think this is before her metastatic diagnosis. You know, there's, I mean, she writes, of course, so much about you and the boys in this book. She also illuminates some of the different ways, at least in the beginning, that you may have had of coping. There's another wonderful section I'd like to read, and I like reading it because her writing is just so, you know, it's really incandescent, you know? It just so illuminates what she's going through. So this is on page 73. It's a short chapter, Dispatch from the Dark. She's talking about you and she lying in bed, and you say to her, I just can't wait for things to get back to normal. And she writes, I'm not sure how to respond. I hadn't realized how attached I have become to the idea that even in all of this, we are moving ahead somehow, and that dealing with all this is something to value. I feel a sharpness in my throat, the slip of the sureness beneath me. And then she tells you, I can't handle you saying that. She says, thinking that way kind of invalidates my whole life right now. I have to love these days in the same way I love any other. So I wonder if you remember when that happened and, you know, what that says about her whole process and how that impacted you and how you may have seen the process.
I mean, that's actually one of my favorite passages in the whole book, and I'm really glad that you asked about that specific passage. I love that passage. And when she first wrote it, when it was still in manuscript form, it was literally on her MacBook. She handed it to me, and I read it, and we like to banter and joke about stuff. And I said, "Oh, great, you made me the anti-hero in the book now." And she was like, "No," and I was like, "No, I'm just kidding." It really struck me, and not in a way where I was like, I mean, obviously she's portraying a fight. What the rest of that scene is basically where it's a scene that anybody who's ever been married will recognize. It's like, do you go to bed angry? How do you make up? And then set in the context of a diagnosis of cancer, obviously it takes on different stakes. But I think it was one of those moments. I mean, I think just given the image that we were discussing earlier, it's like I was still a little bit in that place where I kind of wanted the clouds to come back and not stare into the chasm. And Nina wasn't in that place. And again, it was for her. It was like, I have to do it this way. I have to be in these moments. I can't rush through them to get to some other moment because that moment might never come. And this is the condition that we're in. And I want to be validated in my existence as a person who has cancer, not just try to, you know, whatever, fight it or get through it or anything like that. And it was a real wake up point for me. I mean, I think it really, in retrospect, in the book at least, probably the best illustration of how fiercely committed she was to really living by the principles that she's writing about in the book. It was like, you know, she was really strident about it, and we didn't fight a lot. We really didn't have that much conflict. It's not that we stopped fighting once she got sick. I mean, we were still a married couple, and we still had lots of things to disagree about. But that, from that point on, I think I really, you know, it was a huge learning process for me too. And learning how to take care of her was a whole lot easier than going through having the disease myself. But I was no more prepared to be that person at the beginning of it all than she was to be terminally ill at age 37 or age 39 when she died. So it was a real gut check, you know. In a way, it was just like this: oh, okay, you know, I really am not. I'm trying to help you as best I can. I'm trying to relate to you, but I haven't seen it through your eyes. And I think for her, it really is a testament to how really she felt her experience had to be authentic, and not authentic in the sense of, like, you know, she had some standard for herself to meet or something like that, but that she didn't want to be in denial about what was happening to her. She didn't want to be, using something as an artificial crutch or a way of, you know, obscuring what was beneath her, that the ground underneath her had fallen away or whatever. And at the same time, she didn't want to be angry or despair or feel victimized by her circumstances. And so she really was walking this tightrope, you know, she was really walking on this. And I had to learn that while I couldn't really be in her place, I couldn't really experience it as she experienced it, I really had a steep learning curve too as her partner to try and learn what she was going through and experience it and listen to her and go off of her cues. But yeah, that I love that scene, and I think she captured it perfectly. Like, I think that's exactly how it happened. I don't know if it's word for word what we said to each other, because I just can't even remember it now, because I remember the version that's in the book. But I can tell you it felt just like that.
Yeah, and what you just said, there's just one final section I'm going to read, because it really is segues so perfectly from what you just said. This is, and I want to stop here for a minute and just say that when I first contacted your publicist about interviewing you, I didn't know that I was going to, in just a couple of weeks, get a diagnosis of cancer myself. And, you know, I luckily, you know, mine is a different kind. Mine is, you know, I'm much older, so it's not aggressive. And it was caught quite early, and everyone says I'm, quote, going to be fine, unquote. But, you know, it's all a crapshoot, and none of us really knows what's going to happen. So this was really, this whole book spoke so deeply to me. But also this section, this is right after she's had a mastectomy. Nina, your wife, has had a mastectomy, and she's, you know, just woken up. She's in the hospital. And she says, right now, you know, and I'm quoting this because it shows the process. You know, you don't just spring into this situation where you know how to react to what's going on with you. So she says, right now, my emotions around it are waiting as if on a shelf, just out of reach. Right now, the focus is completely physical, almost geographical. Right now, the drain in my chest, the sore armpit, the way my shirts sag on one side. But there are all the other things, too. The obliterated sense of femininity, the skewing of self, the strangeness of the body. I can't quite find the terms to understand that part yet. I guess that's why this fact is so very elephantine right now. It's definitely there, but I can't seem to figure out what to say about it yet. So right now I train my eye on these dreamlike certainties. A cure of doctors will examine me in the morning. And in the meantime, a cauldron of thunderstorms simmers on the horizon, and an anticipation of cocktails awaits some ice. What a beautiful passage in the way that she goes so deeply into the darkest part of what's happening to her and then pulls it right back to the moment.
Yeah, and that that passage is wonderful, and it's, you know, it's so Nina. It's this, that, you know, it's continuation of the earlier part in that same chapter, I think, or an earlier chapter, where she's going through all these names for groups of animals, and that she was always fascinated by those. She just loved that there was this just totally random smattering of terms, you know, a congress of this and a murder of crows and a whatever, you know, all these different things. And the way that she wove that into her own narrative, and just like you said, I mean, that she was able to, I mean, that's sort of a whimsical thing. It's really all about a combination of beauty and whimsy that these zoologists or biologists or whoever decided to do that started naming animals that way. And it comes off as downright silly sometimes when you hear the actual terms for them. But it's also, they're also actually descriptive and they're actually used. And so I love that she was able to weave that into that section where she's talking about some really heavy duty stuff. And the obliteration of the self part of cancer is not, I mean, there's plenty of writing about that and people know it really well. I mean, there's photographers who have done really beautiful books of women post-mastectomy, and it really is and there's the history of the mastectomy, the radical mastectomy, and all this stuff is just unnecessarily disfiguring things that happen to women who had breast cancer for years, because most of the people doing the research and doing the surgeries were men and didn't take any of that stuff into consideration. And there's a lot packed in there. And it's really, you know, in Nina's writing, I think is really very personal. It's not, she's not making a broader social point, but every person who has that kind of surgery or who goes through chemo and loses all their hair and has to go around in a completely transformed state and has to, you know, go through their whole, you know, reproductive system shutting down, which happens when you have massive doses of chemotherapy, has to cope with that, you know, finding themselves. And they, in Nina's case, she had to do it with a partner. And it's like, you know, even if you're just, if you're not out there in the world looking for a partner and worried about your body or your appearance that way, it still has a profound impact on you, on your intimacy, on your interactions with people. It has an impact on whether your six-year-old is, you know, put off by the fact that you have a bald head all of a sudden, and that kind, that level of intimacy. And we certainly went through that. And I love that she conveys that in passages like that, where, I mean, she was a poet, right? So she was, this is the first publication, creative at least publication, that Nina did that wasn't poetry. She wrote for other publications that were, where she did nonfiction stuff. But other than that, she was a creative writer, and her medium was poetry. So you can tell in these sort of more lyrical passages that that's still a major influence on her writing. And it really is effective and indicative of the way that she wrote and the way she created, because it packs a lot into every image and every line. And I feel like I can mine that stuff and really access a lot of her in the images and the words that she chose.
John Duberstein, talking about his late wife's memoir, The Bright Hour. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with John Duberstein about his late wife's book, published just a month after her death from metastatic breast cancer, The Bright Hour, A Memoir of Living and Dying. The book is a powerful and lyrical exploration of confronting mortality with unflinching courage. It's also, in parts, very funny. I have a kind of a confession. I said that I had, you know, I was diagnosed a couple of weeks after first contacting your publicist. So we put off this interview for several months, and I put off reading this book because, being in the midst of, you know, first the surgery and then the treatment, I just felt like, oh, I don't want to read this. But then I had to read it. And I found not only that it was, you know, such a powerful book and so meaningful to me, but also not a grim book by any means. In fact, there's quite a bit of humor in it.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really important thing from Nina's perspective. I wish she were here to express some of this stuff, but I really think it's not an accident that there's a lot of funny stuff in the book. And I think of things both about her and about her mom, because both of them really dealt with not just death and dying, but just being a cancer patient or being a mom or going through difficult things with a great deal of humor. And there's that great passage where Nina's talking about her mom, and she mentions that her mom's favorite thing to do, Nina set up a Bitmoji, you know, the app where you have a little avatar that's sort of a caricature of you. And she set it up for her mom, and her mom loved it. And her favorite one was the one where there's like a picture of somebody laughing, and it's the Grim Reaper behind them, and it says literally dying. And of course her mom was literally dying at the time. So there, it was just, she thought that was absolutely hilarious. And that's in the book. And the stuff with her good friend Ginny, who was diagnosed with they met actually because of their diagnoses right around the same time, with the same type of aggressive cancer, triple negative breast cancer that became metastatic. And the two of them had the best rapport with just really dark humor. They had this idea for a series of thank you cards for people who have cancer that were just really off color and sarcastic. Things like, you know, thank you for the casserole. It worked better than any of my stool softeners. And, you know, all of these really just sort of darkly comic ideas that, you know, that lots of things while her mom was dying, and then even while Nina was dying, up to and including the time when she was in hospice, where humor was a way to express things. And it was just integral to who both of them were. You know, she mentions in the book that her mom liked to tell off-color jokes, and that's absolutely true. A couple glasses of wine, and Jan would tell the most dirty jokes at the party and tell them badly, like with terrible timing. And, you know, they'd be 10 times funnier every time she told them, because she never told them the same way twice. And I think with Nina, one of the reasons that it's so disarming and it's so the book is so friendly to read is because it really takes the edge off of a lot of this stuff and allows you to feel like you're talking with somebody. It's the same thing as people not wanting to bring up the person after they've died. People don't want to bring up your cancer necessarily, but if they see you joking about it and they read and you're joking about it and making light of it and seeing the absurdities in the everyday life of somebody who has to go through all of this treatment and surgery and all this stuff, to me as a reader, you know, I know I'm obviously not your average reader of Nina's work, but I really do think it's disarming and lightening, and it allows for the book to really truly be a page turning experience, not one where obviously, you know, Nina died in February and everybody knows that that happened. It's a foregone conclusion with the book, and that's not made easier necessarily as an element of the story just because there are funny parts, but it's a journey that's not one that's hard to take once you start it. I really think people will genuinely enjoy the book. And I've said to people over and over again, I will, you know, I'll pay for your copy of the book if you don't actually laugh out loud at least once when you're reading it. And I think that's true.
Now, the title, that comes from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's from a passage where Emerson is describing this experience. I think he's describing the morning. And just the way the sun is hitting and the light is behaving. And it's a really beautiful passage, but it's also there's this inflection of orange in that passage. And as she was writing the book, she realized that that was kind of a leitmotif, even though she hadn't meant for it to be. Her mom, shortly before she died, became that she just said all of a sudden orange is my new favorite color, and it had been purple for 50 years. And this was like within weeks of her dying. And there's this great passage where she's unable to calm down. She's having a health crisis in the middle of the night, and Nina's father is trying to calm her down. And the only way he can do it is getting her to meditate on the color orange, which is also a major trope in Buddhism. And there's all these little places in the book where the color orange appears and this idea of light appears. There's another passage where she's talking about, you know, this is towards the end of the book, and the light is fading and the kids are playing in the backyard. And she's talking about this idea of just of being in that moment of the, you know, this time the sun's going down, it's not coming up, but and enjoying that moment. And I think the line at the end of the book is something along the lines that she's not going to call the kids in. She's nothing will make me call them in. But this idea of light, and I think of the moment, that hour of the day, is what Emerson was talking about being illuminated, is really this idea of presence and awareness and, you know, the same appreciation of the moment, even when the moments are failing and running out. So, yeah, I think it's a really befitting title. She actually wrestled with the title a lot, and we spitballed titles back and forth with her editor a bunch and brainstormed a lot. And ultimately, I think, as with all good titles, it was already there in the book, and it just needed to be brought to the fore, to the cover.
You know, one final question, and one that you definitely don't have to answer, because I understand, you know, parents want to keep their children away from the public eye. But your children do figure very prominently in the book. They're pretty impressive kids, I have to say, especially one of your sons who just, I can't remember which one, but has a beautiful way with words. I think he really follows his mom in that. I wonder if you could just say a bit about how this book, I don't know if they've read it, but how the whole process of her writing and you talking about it and the whole process that they have gone through has, how are they doing right now?
They're great. I mean, they're amazing. I don't know how kids, it's hard for me at this stage of my life to really put myself in their shoes, and I'm working on that because I think, for exactly the reason you just said, which is I want to make sure that I get where they're at and not just, you know, try to be doing right by them in an adult way, but really try and see the world through their eyes if I can, because, you know, they lost their mom. They lost their grandma not that long before that. And they were, you know, those were two hugely important relationships. I would say Nina was, you know, everybody's parents are both of them very important. But, you know, Nina was just so, she loomed so large for them. I mean, she was so nurturing and so dynamic in terms of making things happen for the kids and injecting things into their lives that wouldn't have been there but for her, that I know that they're feeling that loss even when they're not articulating it. But, you know, they've attended book events with me. They went to the book launch event that we did out in San Francisco, and they interacted with the audience a little bit, and they interacted with me. And the two of them even, they signed books for people, whether the people wanted them to or not. I think Benny, my younger son, actually signed Lucy Kalanithi, who was there doing the event with us and whose husband wrote When Breath Becomes Air, had this old battered copy of the book that she'd been toting around with her, and it was all dog-eared and marked. And Benny just took it upon himself to take the book and sign the inside of it because it was a book signing, and he felt like, you know, he was part of the book signing. And she, Lucy was fine with it. It was, she was actually very touched and thought it was a really nice gesture. But I was a little horrified at first as the parent of the kid who's defacing somebody's, you know, really cherished object. They haven't read the book yet, and the reasons are many, I guess, and I'm not 100% sure that I'm right about that, but I feel like the book was not written for kids, mm-hmm. even for her kids. And even though we were very open with them, we did not divulge everything to them the way that we would to an adult. Obviously, we parented and we parsed out information as appropriate, but we also didn't do things much in secret when Nina was sick and being treated and then dying. And they spent a lot of time with their mom in hospice. You know, the hospice facility was really wonderful. We decided to do it at a facility and not for her to come home, partly because of the architecture of our house and the setup of our house was not real great for that, but also because we knew that hospice would be a place where, you know, the kids could come and go, and then they could also be away from it if they needed to be, and they could go and be with friends and come back and all that kind of stuff. So I think they had a really close and in touch experience of all the things that went down with their mom. But also, kids are hard to read, and it's one of my bigger anxieties as a parent now is, you know, making sure that they are okay with it. I do think that the book ultimately is a gift for them too. And I think that as they get older, you know, Benny was 6 years old when Nina was diagnosed, and he's not going to have nearly as many memories of his mom as his older brother will. And both of them are going to lose, you know, obviously you don't really start remembering things until you're 4 or 5 years old. And so I think the book will give them a lot. And I'm also trying to assemble books of pictures. Apple and other places have these wonderful things where they give you templates and you can put a picture book together and things like that. So I'm trying to supplement, and I'm trying to think about what might be meaningful for them down the road, not just right now. But overall, they've been so terrific. I mean, they've just been as adaptable, and, you know, they'll engage on those things when I really want them to, or sometimes on their own, but they don't seem overly burdened by it. And I attribute a lot of that to the fact that their mom did a good job preparing them, you know, and if we've had any smoothness, I shudder to call the last, you know, 6 or 8 months or 2 years of our life smooth. But if we've handled any of it well, and we've really been able to cope and deal and process, I attribute a lot of it to that same preparedness that started with Nina's mom and continued with her. And we've really, you know, up through and including the book that she left behind, has really enabled us to do all that stuff.
And you had a big part in that too. And I want to thank you, John Duberstein, for joining us here on Writer's Voice and sharing these stories with us.
Thanks so much, Francesca. I really, really enjoyed being here.
And that was John Duberstein. He is the husband of Nina Riggs, the author of The Bright Hour, a memoir of living and dying. And about that title, The Bright Hour, I'd like to read for you the quotation from Ralph Waldo Emerson, Nina Riggs' ancestor, that gave her the title for this book. Emerson writes, "I am cheered with a moist, warm, glittering, budding, and melodious hour that takes down the narrow walls of my soul and extends its pulsation and life to the very horizon. That is mourning. To cease for a bright hour to be a prisoner of the sickly body and to become as large as the world." When John Duberstein lost his wife, he had had time to prepare as she passed through the stages of her mortal illness. When Dante scholar Joseph Luzzi lost his wife, it happened in an instant. Here's a clip from my 2015 interview with him about his memoir, In a Dark Wood. When his nearly 9 months pregnant wife was killed in a car accident, Dante scholar Joseph Luzzi found himself in that figurative dark wood that Dante wrote about in the opening verses of the Divine Comedy. Luzzi's daughter was delivered by emergency C-section. His wife died just 45 minutes later. In an instant, Luzzi found himself utterly exiled from his previous life. There was no way back, and it appeared at first, no way forward. But then, as he threw himself into his work to escape the unbearable pain of grief, Luzzi found his consolation in the book he had been studying and teaching for 20 years, Dante's Divine Comedy. Where Dante's fictional self had Virgil as his guide, Luzzi now found a like guide in Dante, whose experience of exile from his beloved Florence spoke profoundly to the dislocation Luzzi himself felt. And he found a message of hope in Dante's arduous struggle toward paradise, a struggle that ends, finally, with love. Joseph Luzzi teaches Italian at Bard College. His memoir is In a Dark Wood, What Dante Taught Me About Grief, Healing, and the Mysteries of Love. I started out by asking Luzzi to read a short passage from his memoir, In a Dark Wood.
The passage that I'm about to read is in chapter 2, which is called Consider Your Seed, and it's really about my return to my hometown, Westerly, Rhode Island, and it's right after my wife's accident and my daughter's birth, and it's about a kind of, obviously, a very sad homecoming in that I was going back to the town I'd grown up in that I'd left when I graduated high school and gone out into the world and now was sort of coming back to it. It's a broken person completely relying on my family to help me raise Isabel, my mom, who was at the time in her late 70s, and my four sisters and my brother that really helped me in a especially my mom actually co-parented with me those early years. And I talk about in this chapter what it means to be in exile in the place that's the most familiar to you in the world, that I had gone back to my hometown and a place that I loved and still do love. But during that period of grief and then mourning, I felt, in exile there. And it reminded me of a very powerful canto in Dante, where his character Ulysses goes back to Ithaca and then actually leaves. And it's this astonishing thing that Dante has him do that's difficult to understand. And now I really believe that Dante's genius was to realize that at a certain point, home can no longer be home. Odysseus / Ulysses gets back to Ithaca after 20 years and finds it's no longer his place and leaves it. So the passage that I'm going to read is part of, during that period of intense grief, what the whole experience of grief felt like. I'll read now. I was living under the spell of what one author, Joan Didion, called magical thinking, the cool-minded craziness of those who expect their loved one back at any moment, ready to put on a familiar pair of old shoes. I knew that Catherine wasn't coming back for those knockout leopard print shoes she wore the night I met her in Williamsburg. Mine was a different kind of magical thinking, the sense that the world began and ended with my own suffering. My grief became an airtight shell, and contrary to the calm outward appearance I cultivated, my sorrow now defined me. Grief was choking my imagination, leaving me incapable of envisioning a different life.
Yeah, that's a very powerful passage. Like so much in your book, the inspiration that you get from Dante is not just through his literature, but also through his life. What is it about Dante's own life that resonated with you during this process?
Dante is one of those writers that, for better or for worse, mostly for better, his work is inseparable from his life, It going back to when he first started out as a poet in his 20s, his first book is an autobiography, The New Life, La Vita Nuova, about his poetic apprenticeship and his relationship with his muse Beatrice. And writing about his life, he did write some other works as a scholar, a philosophical work, The Convivio, and a wonderful history of the Romance languages. But when he comes back to his life in the Divine Comedy in around 1305, he's been exiled for a few years. And though the Divine Comedy is about so many things, you know, it's about politics, history, it's about obviously religion, the character of Dante is central to it. And I had spent my life studying the poem and teaching it and writing about it. And Dante can be a very opaque writer because so much of his poem is about Christian doctrine, because there's so many allusions into it, to other works in it. But I started to hear his voice in a way that I never had before. And so when you ask about Dante the person, I think that I really came to understand, I believe, why he wrote the poem. And I think it had so much to do with not the death of Beatrice, his muse, Beatrice, but really his exile from Florence. In 1302, he was banished for life from the city, his hometown. And he spent the last 20 years of his life basically wandering around Italy, never at home. In the first few years, he tried to get back to Florence. And that was when he was probably at his lowest point ever. And it's only when he accepted his exile that he was able to basically sit down and write this remarkable poem. So I started to feel Dante the person because I heard there's a wonderful passage about his exile where I actually started to hear his voice and almost could basically feel his own suffering. And I realized at a certain point that that voice of his, that voice expressed his motivation in writing the Divine Comedy. And it became a kind of symbol to me in my own despair of what you can do with your lowest, most tragic news and moment in life is to kind of struggle with it and to try and do something with it and make something out of it, you know, when you're back on your feet enough to do it. And so Dante's kind of example and his incredible courage became an inspiration to me as much as, you know, his personal courage, as much as the majesty of his writing became a kind of companion to me as I was working my own way out of what I call the dark wood, which is Dante's image for that moment in life where you're in your great crisis and it can go one way or the other. You know, you can sort of be defeated or find something within to get through. And so I think that, you know, his personal story, which is certainly part of the Divine Comedy, became a story that I, you know, really took to heart as I thought about what my wife's death had done to my own life.
So, as you say, your mom was a co-parent. Your daughter was essentially raised by your mother the first 4 years of her life, because even though you were co-parents, you had great difficulty in kind of centering your life around your daughter at the time. Tell us about that and why.
You know, that was as I was writing the book, as you can imagine, it wasn't an easy book to write. It was a book I felt I had to write because I'm a reader and a writer and a professor of literature. It was a natural that I would turn to books about grief and mourning. I felt that there wasn't something that kind of captured what I experienced, and that I hope by writing something, other people could see their own loss in it as well. And I wanted to do something to remember my late wife at the same time show what Dante's impact had in a positive way, how he had helped lead me through. But as I was writing it, some things were so painful to admit, and that was the hardest one. That my daughter, who ultimately saved me and rescued me, you know, being a father to her, for the first years, it was very hard to embrace fatherhood. I became, as I said in the book, a widower and a father on the same day. And I think that the first year I was in shock and processing it and grieving over my wife, and my family gave me the space to do that. And I think that was necessary. But that meant that, you know, part of me was absent from day-to-day life. And raising a kid, of course, you have to put their needs before your own. And I tried to do the best I could, but it was just, it was such a difficult period that I was completely reliant on my family, especially my mom, who had raised six children of her own and, you know, had already had, when Isabel was born, 13 grandchildren. So we were kind of in the storm together for years. And I think that it took a long time for me to make, as I talk about in the book, the transition from being a father, being there as much as I could, to really being her dad, to centering my life around her, to, you know, making her the focus. You know, after Catherine died, my late wife, I threw myself into my career. It was something that I needed to kind of keep going and to keep me propped up, as so many other things had fallen by the wayside. And so I felt, as anyone in that situation, I think I had a lot of misgivings. I blame myself. Why didn't I, you know, slow things down and really build a calm, quiet life with Isabel at the center of it? I think in retrospect, I just, you know, the experience was so shattering that for that first, certainly the first year of, was just grief. And then as kind of mourning settled in a way that became harder because that was sort of, you're back to your regular life and people, even though they feel bad and people are incredibly supportive, you know, life goes on and your life goes on. But I was still kind of clutching at that, you know, the life that I had and wanting it back, a version of it. So it took a long time. Something that was, I had dreamed of my whole life, something that I assumed would be a given, to be, you know, building a life with my daughter, took a very long time to build.
Joseph Luzzi talking with us about his memoir, In a Dark Wood, in 2015. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Carol Anderson about her book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award this year. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.